Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Every pregnancy comes with its own challenges and mysteries. Those 9 months are a lesson in waiting and hoping, and there isn't a guidebook for the intense emotions people feel along the way. This week's essay, written by David Lavza, explores the emotional terrain of pregnancy and what that can feel like when things go right and when they go wrong. Sterling K. Brown delivers this week's story. He's nominated for an Emmy this year for his portrayal of Christopher Darden in the FX series The People vs. O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story. Here's Sterling reading David Lavza's essay, My First Son, A Pure Memory.
Having waited until we were in our 30s to start a family, my wife and I were having trouble conceiving, leading to sperm tests, hormone shots, and other extraordinary measures. Over many months, the process of conception became so technical that when Lisa told me she was at last pregnant, I found it hard to know what to credit. After the first ultrasound, she came home with a black and white picture of a tiny, curled-up creature. We put it on the refrigerator. My son, the lima bean. At 20 weeks, we went in together for the second ultrasound. The technician made small talk and popped his gum as he dimmed the lights. Lisa lay back on the table. I shifted in my seat, jammed my hands into my pockets, and stretched out my legs like a teenager settling in to watch a movie. As the technician slid the paddle around on Lisa's belly, the image on the computer screen wheeled, dipped, and blurred. Finally, my son's image popped into focus. Arms and legs folded, he seemed to be resting on his back, as if lying on the bottom of a pool, waiting to spring to the surface. The technician muttered something, hit a button to freeze the image, and walked briskly out of the room. A few minutes later, in walked a small man wearing a rumpled white coat and steel-rimmed glasses, his bow tie askew. He shut the door behind him. I don't remember exactly what he said. He looked as if someone had left him out in the rain. What we had taken for a frozen image, he explained, was in fact absolute stillness. We still refer to the man as Dr. Death. Always sad, always breaking bad news. They keep him in a closet somewhere. A year later, pregnant with our second son, Benjamin, my wife turned a corner at the hospital and saw him at a nurse's station. She did an abrupt, involuntary about-face. After Dr. Death left, our midwife arrived to explain that we had a decision to make. Did we want to schedule a D&C, or did we want to induce labor? Her language was very plain, but it took a while for me to understand what she was really asking. Did we want the pregnancy to end in a surgical procedure in the outpatient clinic or in the maternity ward as a stillbirth? We asked whether there were medical advantages or disadvantages to either choice. She told us it was simply a matter of preference. No hurry. Let us know. On the drive home, we were mostly silent. As if exchanging telegrams, Lisa and I said what we needed to and no more. We each assumed there was only one possible decision, so when we talked logistics, appointments to reschedule, job responsibilities to manage. We asked questions we might have asked the midwife about recovery time. Then we realized we weren't in agreement. I was talking about the D&C, while Lisa had decided to give birth. Incredulous, I asked why she would want to go through all that pain. She said she couldn't imagine just getting rid of our child by a surgical procedure. She wanted to see him. So I had to ask myself, why didn't I want to meet my own son? We pulled into the driveway, phoned the hospital, turned around and drove back. Going to the hospital for a stillbirth is the photographic negative of going for a live birth. You carry the overnight bag, check into a room in the maternity ward, and so on. But they put a marker on your door to alert the nurse midwives that, in this room, things are different. As a means of inducing labor in a body that is not yet ripe, Pitocin is brutally effective. But it can take a while to kick in. After an hour of flipping through magazines, Lisa and I decided to take a walk. The nurse said it might speed things along. Wandering about in the midwinter dusk, Seattle sinking to the bottom of the gray scale, we were about a quarter mile from the hospital, just about to turn around when the drug took hold, doubling Lisa over. We considered calling a cab, but she decided she could make it, so we stumbled back with her arm around my shoulders for support. By the time we reached Lisa's room, her contractions were frequent and prolonged, much more so than they would have been at the early stages of a natural labor, and each surge of pain seemed to levitate her body above the sheets. When at last the anesthesiologist gave her an epidural, Lisa sighed and fell back into the pillows. Within an hour, she was asleep, and shortly after that, I dozed off as well, like a lab curled up in an armchair at the foot of her bed. My first son was born sometime in the gray dawn. In such cases, there's no rupturing of waters. The birth sac slips out whole and unbroken. The bag was a little bigger than my fist. The midwife put it on a towel and, with a small pair of scissors, carefully snipped it open. She unfolded our son's limbs, disentangling one from the other, unfurling him like a new leaf, talking softly to us all the while, describing him. He was about 5 inches long, she said. He was anencephalic, which means his brain and nervous system had failed to develop. He had probably died about a week earlier. Gingerly, she handed him to Lisa, and though it was clear that Lisa wanted to hold him longer, it was only a minute or two before she passed him to me. Later, Lisa told me she was afraid he would come apart in her hands. Resting on my outstretched hand, he was thin, nearly weightless, his skin pinkish-gray and translucent. He seemed to me less like a small baby than a scale model of a stripling child. I cradled his head between the ends of my middle and ring fingers, his features peaceful, perfect, blank. His feet reaching nearly to my wrist, his toes were like mine and my father's, the second toe longer than the big toe. When we got back from the hospital, the epidural had not quite worn off, so Lisa did not have the full use of her legs and clung to me as we staggered up the front steps. Thinking of ourselves as a public spectacle, how must we look to the neighbors, drunk again, we burst out laughing. Once inside, the bleak humor continued. Anencephalic? All right, so he won't go to Harvard. It wasn't until I had settled Lisa onto the couch that my own legs quit working. I was in mid-sentence, something about an errand, tea kettle in hand, halfway between the tap and the stove. A spasm went through me. I doubled over and I heard my own voice howling from far off, the full-throated cry of a child. On the day I went back to the small college where I work, I felt myself in another kind of altered state, not above the flow of daily life, but just below its surface, heavy, settled, still. I had been thinking about how to tell people, my colleagues, my students. Some knew that Lisa and I had been expecting a child. Clearly, I had to tell them what happened. Others didn't know about the pregnancy, though. Should I spring the whole story on them all at once? When a parent dies, or a partner, when we lose someone who has lived in the world, there are customs, worn paths to follow, ways to talk about it. But I didn't see any paths with this. Was I supposed to keep quiet and pretend nothing had happened? I couldn't accept that. So I typed out an email message, brief and plain, explaining Lisa had been pregnant, the child had died, and we took some comfort from the belief that all he had ever known was love. I stared at the screen for a long time. Then I clicked on the top of the email program and addressed the message to everyone at the college. Faculty members, students, staff, people I knew well, people I didn't know at all. I had a fleeting thought that this might be inappropriate, but then I pressed send. It felt like a form of protest. I wasn't really looking for a response. I just wanted to get the news out. I couldn't bear to repeat it over and over. And although my department's administrative assistant did field a few complaints about receiving something so personal by a general message, who is this guy? Most apparently understood, or at least excused, my gesture. And then came the outpouring. For weeks after, people I barely knew would come into my office, gently shut the door, and burst into tears. I heard stories of single and serial miscarriages, pregnancies carried nearly to full term, stillbirths. All the lost children. Grief hauled about and nowhere to put it down. Some said they had never told anyone. Who would understand? My first son is like the faintest scar on my skin now, nearly hidden. Over time, will the mark disappear as my skin becomes mottled and wrinkled? Lisa was planning to bury his ashes, about a teaspoonful, in the garden, part of which was to be his. Instead, she kept his ashes in the bedside table drawer, right next to her, as if afraid he would wake in the night and need her. She felt him close to her. A wisp of spirit, the smallest presence. When Benjamin was very young, just beginning to speak in sentences, he asked if he had a brother once. Lisa paused a moment before answering, but by the time she started to speak, he had moved on to something else.
Sterling K. Brown, reading David Loves' essay, My First Son, A Pure Memory. There's more after the break. We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And now a postscript from the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, Daniel Jones, and the author of this week's essay, David Lovsa.
Well, we lost James in 2001, and then a year later, Benjamin was born. So he's now a 14-year-old, and 6 foot tall and rail thin. He's like a walking exclamation point and a lovely child. I had written the essay for, it was actually a collaboration between three faculty where I teach, and we were all writing each other's assignments in a creative writing class. And I had never written a personal essay before, but that was the homework, so I wanted to write something that was close to the bone, that was personal.
David's essay is such an example of the power of description and the well-chosen detail to carry emotion, and it's really a kind of magic how he, during these emotional parts of this essay, just pulls back and describes how holding his son and unfurling his son's limbs like a new leaf, that's a description that has stuck with me for years. This is an essay that just moves me as much on the 30th read as the first read.
And every time a story gets published in Modern Love, it takes a very private experience and turns it into a very public one. David and his wife Lisa had no idea what to expect.
People all over the world read this essay, and the reaction was pretty immediate and very strong. I heard from one man who said that it had been 50 years ago that he and his wife had a stillborn child, and they never talked about it. They didn't talk about it at the time. And he said this was the first time that he'd ever cried about it when he read the piece. So it was really clear to Lisa and me that there was a story here that was something that people really needed to hear.
You know, the truth is, of course, there's no real accepted way to act or to grieve for any kind of loss. You go through what you go through. And in this case, he just does what he feels like he needs to do, and it serves as this, you know, release valve for all these other people who have gone through similar things. You know, what a relief that is to be able to tell your story. And in a large sense, this is what the column does with essays like this. It serves as a pressure release for all these people who've gone through similar things and haven't found the words for them and haven't found a way to tell their own story, and suddenly it all just comes pouring out.
Well, we wanted to know more about what David's wife Lisa thought, so we invited her into the studio and asked her what it was like to see David's essay in print.
You know, I think it's important to hear from a dad. Most of the literature that I've read, anyway, is by moms. But, you know, it's also hard to be the partner of a woman who's trying and failing to stay pregnant. Obviously, I'm biased, but I think David's writing is so truthful and compassionate. I'm happy to give up a little privacy for his work to be out there.
Yeah, it's really unusual to get a male perspective on a lot of relationship issues. And, you know, only about 20-25% of submissions and stories we publish in Modern Love are from a male perspective, but to really dig deep emotionally is more rare. So I was so appreciative to get this perspective from a man.
In 2015, David published a memoir called Walking Distance: Pilgrimage, Parenthood, Grief, and Home Repairs. Included in that memoir was the story of their second son, Benjamin's birth. It was a very challenging one. Halfway into her pregnancy, Lisa almost lost Ben and almost lost her own life. She spent the last few weeks of the pregnancy in the hospital.
So when Ben finally arrived, I came to mothering with a deep intention to live with no regrets. And to clarify, no regrets for me doesn't mean some impossible image of being a perfect mother, because that's crazy. I yell at my kid, I get impatient, I get bored. But every day I really try to connect with Ben authentically to let him know that I love him completely. So no matter what happens, he'll know that my love for him is immutable.
David, Lisa, and Benjamin live in Seattle. Lisa teaches yoga, and David heads the theater arts department at St. Martin's University. Ben will be a freshman in high school this year.
There is a delight that comes after you've been through a grieving process, I think, where you start to see what is a blessing in the world much more clearly. And I don't think we're unduly anxious parents for all of this.
Given the context, I
Given
say
the
we're
context.
we're pretty relaxed.
That's David Lavza, author of this week's essay, and his wife, Lisa Holtby. They've been married for 27 years. You also heard from Dan Jones, the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. Special thanks to Sterling K. Brown for reading this week's essay. We asked him what drew him to this particular story.
I'm a father of two young boys, and so I think being a father touches me. I lost my own father when I was 10 years old, so stories of fathers and sons just sort of speak to the core of my heart. And just imagining what it must be like to be in these parents' shoes and acknowledging the existence of your first child and having a second child, but, you know, remembering and appreciating even more that Benjamin had come into their lives, it just spoke to me. It was the story that I had to tell.
Sterling picked up his first Emmy nomination for his work on The People vs. O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story. Find out if he wins on September 18th. He also stars in the new NBC dramedy, This Is Us, which premieres September 20th. Find out who's coming up next week on the podcast after the break. Next week on Modern Love, Oscar and Emmy Award-nominated actor Angela Bassett reads a story about a psychic and a sickness.
I remember staring at the sea of green carpet in her home as she addressed the usual concerns. She told me to marry Mark, the man I was living with, that I would have a son and a daughter, and that my future with him would not be in New York City, contrary to what I had long assumed. Finally, I asked the question I really wanted answered. When will I die?
And later this week on Modern Love, we hear some of your stories about near-death experiences and what they taught you about love.
My husband was my anchor during this time. He had to juggle a gravely sick wife, a newborn, and a toddler at home. I truly felt like I was in a death spiral, and I just didn't see a scenario in which I left the hospital alive.
Never miss an episode of Modern Love. Subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, and sign up to receive Modern Love email updates at nytimes.com/lovetalk. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Our casting consultant is Amy Lippins. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. And thanks to Buzzy's Recording in Los Angeles. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.